now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. As ever on a Thursday, we have Martin Samuel, Chief Correspondent of The Times and Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, Football Correspondent of The Sunday Times, and for the first time this season, James Restall, Deputy Sports Editor. I'm getting those all right, am I? Okay. I'm Gregor Robertson. Lots to get through today. Transfer, some of the most interesting transfers going on over the last few days. We'll review some of the midweek action. Look forward to Brighton versus Newcastle and Arsenal Manchester United, as well as looking once again at the story that will not go away involving Luis Rubiales in Spain. But first of all, probably the most eye-catching transfer, certainly in the last week or so, probably the most interesting transfer of the last week is of Cole Palmer to Chelsea from Manchester City for up to £45 million. What do you make of this one, Martin? It seems to be a kind of one that has risk on both sides, but also, you know, is very interesting. It's a player that has been developed since the age of eight by Manchester City, and after so few appearances, but so much potential, they're willing to move him on.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. You could argue that they're being very fair, that they can't see a way through for him in the current Manchester City team, and therefore they've set him free, basically. And free to go to Chelsea, who are Manchester City's rivals, big rivals. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that the immense frustration that you must feel as a young British player in our football, where you can't get through because Haaland and Alvarez and every, you know, every way you look, it's blocked off. I don't think it's a big risk for Chelsea, because I think he's a good player, and he looks to me a really good player, and he looks as if he'll score goals, and goals are what Chelsea need. I also look here and think, I've never been a great fan of the loan system, and I know I'm in a minority on this, and that it benefits a lot of clubs further down the league, and it allows development and yada yada yada. I've always had that old school attitude that you can't run a shop with somebody else's stock, and I just wonder, if we didn't have the loan system, whether you would see more instances like this, whether young players would be, good young players would become more evenly distributed through the league, rather than having half a dozen clubs that can just hang on to them and keep them there because they can loan out all over the place, and this allows them to actually, although the first team squad is 25 or whatever, actually have a squad near 40 because all of these young players are here, there and everywhere. Whether this is what would have to happen, you just get to a certain age and you'd say to the manager, I can't see a way through for me here, or you'd sign a contract that allowed you to get out if you weren't in the team by a certain time. I don't know, but I think it's a great deal for Chelsea. I know it's a lot of money, and I know he hasn't played much, but I think he's a lovely player. And I'm very, very surprised that Manchester City can't find some way of using him.
Mm. What about you, Johnny? What about from Manchester City's perspective?
I find that a strange one from a cultural perspective for City. You know, they've won three titles in a row. They've won the treble. I don't think they're at a position where they have to think short term. There's no need to get a trophy now. I think they can think a bit more about development than they maybe have been able to at other points in their history. And from that perspective, he's the next one after Foden, with maybe Rico Lewis, you could say, as well. Those are the three outstanding prospects that their academy's produced in the last 10 years. And to sell him at this stage when he had a really good season last year where he used the most of his opportunities. He had a brilliant under-21s championship. Mm-hmm. He looks such a lovely player, such a Guardiola player, potentially. To let him go now and then to be signing Mateus Nunes at the same time for actually slightly more money, I don't understand that one. For me, I would see the next stage of City's development is surely going down the route of I suppose Ferguson's United and adding to success by producing their own players and having a recognisable local element to the team. I don't understand it from that point of view. And the odd thing, I agree with Martin about how we definitely want young players to go and play and the talent to be spread. I think Chelsea's a slightly weird choice for Cole Palmer if he thinks I want to go somewhere I'm guaranteed minutes, because I'm not sure if there is any guarantee of minutes at Chelsea, but then maybe he's had assurances that we don't know about.
Is he a player that Chelsea really need? I mean, I know there's this new target on youth, and they needed someone who could play across the forward line. But they also look really inexperienced a lot of the time. They need someone who is more likely to get a guarantee of goals.
He scores goals. He has scored goals, with very limited exposure to the first team. He's got goals.
That goal he scored in the European Championship in the summer, where he slides in at the back post, is exactly what Chelsea have been missing, really. Somebody with that real poacher's instinct and a great timing. I can see why they've gone for him. But it's what I find so strange about it is that we've kind of been led to believe that this was the not quite the breakthrough season, but this was the season where he'd get more minutes and he'd be coming off the bench. He played a great role in the Community Shield, and it just it feels a really weird one that they would now go, right, we're going to stop your development here and sell you. I thought this would be the season for him.
And it's weird because at the same time we've got Chelsea selling their academy players, like your Lewis Halls.
It's accountancy as well. I mean, as they've spoken about before, the pure profit in terms of, being financial fair play regulations.
That's 100% right. And I think if you look, the Italian clubs have done this for years. Juve and the Milan clubs have been quite happy to trade young players.
Trade with each other,
And maybe we're in that phase now, but if you think that Chelsea and City are the two outstanding academies of the last decade and how few of those players actually then end up on the pitch for those teams and how they're willing to sell them in order to buy new young players from elsewhere, there's just...
They use them as a revenue stream.
They do. It's football factory.
It's not an academy as we would know an academy from years past. It is a revenue stream because once you've got financial fair play, and I know I'm on again in a minority here, but once you've got financial fair play and once you make everything about the bottom line, then everything does become about the bottom line. And you look at the bottom line for your academy, you look at the bottom line, dare I say it, as much of a PR own goal as it is, you look at the bottom line for the £250,000 you're spending on your away supporters to get on a coach and stuff like that. Everything becomes about the bottom line.
It's been really funny in the last couple of years, basically since Chelsea have been taken over, a line has crept into reporting, which is whenever an academy player is sold, it's always mentioned is pure profit.
That has become
commonplace now. Yeah. Reporting. It's in our story this morning about Cole Palmer, and it's why City would be mad to turn down a player that is at £45 million of pure profit.
Because everything is about that loss, what you lose.
Yep.
So therefore, everything becomes that simple profit and loss calculation.
But Paul Hurst also written that in the paper today that Manchester City could look a little bit silly at the end of this. If Palmer's to develop into a full England international and flourish, then it could look like a steal as well.
I agree, because he has got that potential. There's no doubt that he's in that under-21 team, he was one of the two or three outstanding players that you thought he's got a chance of even the next squad. Gibbs White would be another one, Anthony Gordon. He's up there with all of those talents. And of course, if he was at some, he would have played a lot more minutes if he'd been at a different club to City, and that's fair enough. But I would have thought that it would just be worth, don't sign Mateus Nunes, give Cole Palmer I know they're slightly different players, but you know, the capacity that Guardiola has for, to develop players and their skills, I'd have thought give him something of a chance. Maybe as you say, Martin, there is one thing in City's thinking that I do have always admired, which is trying to be fair to players who want to go. They're not a club that holds on to players who want to go. So it could be there's something a bit more behind this story in terms of the player pushing to leave that we don't know. But is he just pushing to leave because he doesn't see any...
Because he doesn't see anyone. And maybe that is what it is. Maybe he's saying, look, banging on Guardiola's door or whatever, and saying, look, you know, what are my chances? What's going to happen here? And if Pep's looking at his team and thinking, well, you're not going to get the opportunities that I thought, because we have found a way of playing that really you're not involved in this at the moment, then maybe he's just thought, well, the decent thing to do is let him go. I'm just surprised that they've let him go to such an obvious rival. I mean, you know, people can, you know, say, oh, Kevin De Bruyne or Mo Salah with Chelsea, but both of those players, they didn't sell Mo Salah to Liverpool and they didn't sell Kevin De Bruyne at Manchester City, they sold them abroad and they came back to haunt them. And both of those players actually had quite a good chance in the first team. I mean, certainly Kevin De Bruyne started the season for Chelsea and he wasn't playing like the Kevin De Bruyne we see now, because if he was, they wouldn't have let him go, quite obviously. Whereas with Palmer, he hasn't really had that run. He hasn't really had that chance.
41 appearances for the
41
most
appearances.
Most of them being from the bench.
Most of them substitute appearances, and most of them, I would imagine, in cup competitions and stuff like that.
There'll be a lot of Champions League dead rubbers in there.
Yeah. Dead rubbers and, you know, turning you up on Burton Albion or whatever, you know, and stuff like that. You know.
Okay, well, another interesting move. This one's not done yet, but it looks as though Ansu Fati,
Dean
sensation, is on the brink of a season-long loan from Barcelona to Brighton. And as you say, he was linked with Tottenham Hotspur, but it seems like Brighton might well have hijacked the move. And this is a really exciting move. Obviously, he's had a bit of a dip in the last year. I think he's had suffered some injuries. But he signed a contract not long ago with a €1 billion buyout clause. You know,
Barcelona accounting.
He was handed Messi's number 10 when the great man left Barcelona. So this could be a really, really exciting move if he comes to the Premier League.
I think it is, because of the scale of the talent, as you say, Gregor. It'd be very interesting, the choice of Brighton ahead of Spurs, but I can understand it from the player's point of view, and that's not to denigrate Spurs. I think that's looking at Roberto De Zerbi and perhaps looking at, I mean, he's turned Solly March into, you know, Maradona or whatever. So Ansu Fati must
too
be
far, Johnny. Too
yeah,
far.
Okay. But he's got a talent for players in those wide positions. I mean, it was Mihailo Mudrik had his one great burst at Donetsk under Roberto De Zerbi. He knew he gets the most out of players in those positions. And it's it looks like a good sort of development choice for Fati, who, you know, he was as you say, supposed to be the next Messi. I remember being at Barcelona Airport a few years ago, but it you know, his shirt was, they were really putting forward that Fati 10 shirt, and he was supposed to be the face of the next gen.
He's still only 20, say.
When you look at Martin Odegaard, and he was, it shows that you can come back from being that protege and it not quite working out, and then you can rebuild. You know, he did all that at the same age with Real Madrid, went to Holland and then came back, and maybe this will be Fati's path.
You'd love as well, or one would love, maybe, I'm not going to speak for everyone, one would love the idea that one of the clubs that six of our teams wanted to cut loose and leave behind is now potentially getting a player off Tottenham. Yeah. You know, Tottenham were one of those teams that, you know, wanted to cut everyone loose. You know, there was no consultation. They were just resigning that day and, you know, they were going to go elsewhere and they were going to be in this league that was a glorified closed shop and everything, meaning that a team like Brighton could pretty much never get into it. And what are we, 2 years on? Yeah. 2 years on, and you know, they might not be able to get this player because he looks at Brighton and fancies Brighton more. And that's not against Tottenham, that is just against this idea of this elite that thought they were so much better than everyone else, because there's not a better run club in the country than Brighton. There's not a club that deserves European football this season more than Brighton deserve their place in the Europa League. It's absolutely fantastic what Tony Bloom has done down there. And this is, if it does come off for them, this is the absolute epitome of it, that they are not just plucky Brighton who find someone for 5 million and turn them into £100 million player. They are now Brighton, a good player, a really good technical player, looks at and thinks, that's a better bet than this team with the 60,000 capacity stadium, the best stadium in the country, and, you know, European football, Champions League, Champions League final in, you know, very, very recent memory.
Does it also suggest that maybe Tony Bloom is going to loosen the purse strings a little bit and back De Zerbi and, you know, show a little bit more ambition? Not that they're not showing it in the past, but I think he reportedly earns £260,000 a week.
I don't think the purse strings need to be loosened, because they're quite, the coffers are quite hefty at the moment.
Well, of course. do you think De Zerbi is going to be backed? I think he always says we want to, we shouldn't, you know, shouldn't limit our ambitions. Does this show that maybe Tony Bloom's listening?
Well, I think he's got a, it's not a problem, but there's certainly a need to keep De Zerbi. You know, he's been looked at by a number of clubs and was looked at even last season. So he has to match De Zerbi's ambition. And De Zerbi's ambition is part of why Brighton have kicked on since Potter, because
they have broken their transfer record this summer. It's kind of gone under the radar, but they have actually broken
it. Yeah, Pedro.
With about 35 million.
Yeah, that's right.
And I know that's not, you know, in the scale of 150 million for Caicedo.
It's big for Brighton.
But it's big for Brighton. I mean, I know this sounds a bit romantic and whatever, but I still have to pinch myself, having sat on that rickety terrace at the Withdean, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and to think this is a team that can lure a player from Barcelona ahead of Tottenham. That to me, sitting on a cold New Year's Day watching my team get beaten 5-0 by Brighton in League One, and you think, here they are now, the team that James Milner wants to come to at the end of his career because he believes what the manager's doing. Adam Lallana.
I read somewhere that they're charging £3.50 for a packet of Starburst. Is that right? I bet that wasn't happening at the Withdean. No. So
lucky to get Starburst.
So, you know, they're moving up in all directions. Yeah.
One chance that doesn't look like it's happening is Harry Maguire's exit to West Ham or anyone else, owing to some injuries at Manchester United. You've written about this week, Martin. What do you think?
Well, I think in the end, it's been timed out, hasn't it? Manchester United don't want him to go now because they've got problems with Van, injury problems with Van and Luke Shaw, Malacia as well, and so they're short at the back, and but there was a time when Manchester United would have driven him down to London to sign for West Ham, and they wanted the money, and Maguire didn't want to go. It was more, I was looking at it from the point of view of West Ham, who've taken 7 points in their first three games, and do you really need the drama of sort of rekindling Harry Maguire's career? Do you really, you know, there was a time when they weren't getting players in, they hadn't bought anybody. Then there was the link to Pacatar and Manchester City when Harry Maguire seemed this sort of great shout for them, you know, former Manchester United captain all the world over, he's England's centre half, and, you know, he could sign for West Ham, and that would have been very appealing. Now, not so much. They've made a good fist of replacing Declan Rice, albeit three games into the season, I realise that. But they've got good results. They're on a little bit of a roll. Yeah. You know, the international break will be coming at exactly the wrong time, as always happens whenever West Ham start well. Well, anyone starts well, really. But
The title charge.
Yeah, the title, yeah, halting. You know, we're always the champions of Europe. But the... you know, everyone knows it's a bigger trophy than that one Man City one. Anyway, that's why they have it first. You know, so the... But you look at that and you think, do you really want to get yourself involved in that little bit of drama that will be surrounding Harry Maguire when he plays his first game, and everyone looking at him and thinking, if he makes a mistake, you know, how does this pan out? That's number one. Number two, we think he'll be named in Gareth Southgate's squad today. And I'm not even sure about that. And I know England have got, Gareth's got his own problems at centre-back and everything, but a guy that chooses to be Manchester United's fifth choice centre-half or whatever he is now, rather than West Ham's first, because at the time when the initial offers and everything were being made, the stories were that David Moyes was saying to him, you know, at the back, you'll be the first name on the team sheet, and Johnny would probably know more about that than any of us. And he elected to either stay at Manchester United or certainly hang around waiting for a payoff from Manchester United. If you're going to Southgate, surely you want players you want to play.
Yeah, that's the trouble for Harry. The sympathy of being sidelined by Ten Hag now runs out when you've had a chance to play and you haven't taken it for whatever reason. And as president of the David Moyes fan club, I think he's missed a big one.
He's just deputy, isn't he? Tom's on the beach though, so.
Oh, fair enough.
You've gone up here today.
But I think Maguire's missed a big opportunity. You know, I was talking about De Zerbi and his facility with forward players. And if you think the players that Moyes has made into or helped make into great centre-halves, England centre-halves, did it at Everton all the time. You know, your Jagielkas and Lescott's and he's revamped Kurt Zouma. He's been able to do that throughout his career. I think Harry would have played because Agard's injured a lot of the time. Ogbonna's old and there's a vacancy there.
And for a guy who is renowned from scoring from set pieces, they've just signed the best set piece takers in the Premier League. We were joking, you know, move over Kane and Son, Ward-Prowse to Maguire would have been the biggest goal scoring combination in the Premier League.
Absolutely.
And they've signed well West, you know, I mean, Edson Alvarez looks a great signing.
Yeah,
there'd have been a nice bit of protection in there. Kudus is good, Ward-Prowse. So, and you know, it could be a long season for Maguire because I was at Old Trafford on Saturday and there's an injury to Varane, and what happens? It's Lindelof that comes on. It's not
last season when there were problems at the back. He was playing Luke Shaw at centre-half. I don't know, Luke can play there and everything, but that's real writing on the wall stuff when they've got the left back in at centre-half and you're still excluded from the team.
Well, but Ten Hag's explicitly said that he's competing with Lisandro Martinez because he wants a left-sided centre-half. So I've got it the wrong way around, haven't I? He's explicitly said that he has to play Harry with a left-footed centre-back, which is going to make it difficult for him because he's competing with Varane, not Lisandro Martinez. But it's going to be hard.
As we mentioned there, the squads, we're recording before the squads announced at 2 p.m. But we think Maguire's in. And there are a few other issues. Also, Calvin Phillips is someone who's in this similar boat, who is an important player for his country, but can't get a game in club football. And Jordan Henderson, of course, has made the move to Saudi Arabia this summer. And we think he's going to still be named in the squad. We have to put caveats here, but these are really interesting decisions for Southgate to make. And with Phillips and Maguire, you wonder how sustainable that is, and perhaps the same is true of Henderson when we see how kind of strong the league is that he's going to be playing in every week.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what Gareth says today, because he'll have to explain why he'd make those selections, and I don't want to jump into a judgment about the Saudi Premier League, because I haven't seen enough of it, to be quite honest. So I don't want to sit here and go it's not a good enough league for an England player to be.
We could say it's a step down, though.
We could say it's a step down, and the thing in my mind is that Gareth's always been quite sceptical, shall we say, about the quality of Serie A.
and the championship.
Yeah, the championship.
You know, he's been quite explicit about the fact that the Premier League's right up there, and if you're not there, it's not quite as good. So you'd think that the same would apply to the Saudi League. This is the first squad of the season, but as the season rolls on, it might be interesting to see how those moves affect player selection.
Sort of reminds me a bit of after the 2018 World Cup. He stayed quite loyal to the group that had got to the semi-final when perhaps one or two were slightly sort of their time had come. But I remember that Nations League game against Spain at Wembley, which kind of was the exposing of the three at the back and the wing backs, and England were promising, but they lost 2-1, and it prompted the sort of first big evolution in Southgate's thinking in terms of both personnel and formation, and it might be that this could be a kind of last hurrah, stroke, last chance for these players who aren't getting minutes.
I was going to say, I think that, you know, if you look back at Gareth and his own playing career and the England managers that he played under, without a doubt, Venables is a massive influence on him in terms of certain things that he's done. And his attitude, Terry's attitude always was, it should be as hard to get out of the England team as it should be to get into it. You know, that once you're in the England team, you've proved yourself over a period of time. That's why you've been selected. And we don't lose faith with you after one bad performance, or we don't lose faith in you because you haven't scored a goal for two games. You think of Alan Shearer, I think it's 9 games without a goal for England before the European Championships. Yeah. With everyone going nuts, everyone saying, why isn't Robbie Fowler playing? Why isn't Les Ferdinand playing? And he kept playing him, and he was going to drop him. He was going to drop him. He wanted him to score a goal. As soon as he scored a goal, he was going to rest him for the next game to play. And he didn't score. He just didn't score. And so he just kept picking him because he knew that as soon as he left him out, everyone would pounce on it. So he just kept picking him. And he went all the way through without a goal. And then the tournament started. And I think he ended tournament top scorer. He did. So, you know, Gareth was in that squad. And he was, you know, he would have heard Terry make that sort of statement that if you're not letting down the international manager, that was another one of Terry's arguments was he can't. And I know Gareth sort of pays lip service to this one about you've got to be playing for your club, but actually he doesn't really follow through with it. He says it and then he picks the people who aren't playing for their clubs anyway. Yeah. And again, that was something else with Terry Venables, that he would say, if all I do is respond to what the manager of a club is doing, then I'm not the England manager. That's the England manager. He's the England manager. If I think so-and-so is the best left-back in the country, but the manager of Manchester United doesn't, well, who's the England manager if I can't pick him because the Manchester United manager isn't picking him? And it's a valid argument, you know, because it could be, supposing the best left-back in the world was at Manchester United and the second best left-back in the world was at Manchester United, but the second left-back in the world was English, then that would mean you wouldn't be picking, that sort of thing. So I can understand it, having said that, would I pick Harry Maguire at the moment? The man's not playing football. Same would apply with me to Calvin Phillips. And I'm not sure Saudi Arabia is the best preparation for playing Ukraine either. But, you know, I think Gareth will go with the people that he knows and that he's, beliefs haven't let him down.
I think the thing with Maguire as well, whilst he has, you know, he's very rarely let Southgate down for England in the games he's played. And at the World Cup, he performed very well. It's a piece I remember you writing, Johnny, when we dissected the France defeat and we went through blow by blow, frame by frame almost. And could he have done better for the Giroud winner? Yes. And ultimately, there are, I think when England have those rare opportunities when they are up against the genuine best teams in the world, which is only going to come in a competitive situation in a World Cup quarterfinal or a World Cup semi-final or a European Championship semi-final, that's when he needs to be absolutely sure that this guy is going to deliver for him. And at the moment, he was exposed in that game, largely because of the fact that I think he wasn't being tested week to week against the best players.
Yeah, no, you're right. That was sharpness, wasn't it? It was just that little lack of
I mean, he's been great for England. There's no doubt about it. There's the, on England performances, of course, Harry Maguire stays in the team. There just comes a critical point where that not playing, and Calvin Phillips is probably in the same zone, just it's gonna affect someone.
We say it every year with PSG, don't we? When PSG, you know, tank in Europe, every single year the same argument is made. Well, if you are so clearly the top dogs in your league, it's made around Bayern Munich as well. Mm-hmm. If you are so clearly the top dogs in your league, you're not tested sufficiently to go deep into the Champions League. You know, you will come up against a team that's been tested the way that, you know, Manchester City went to Sheffield United last week and had a game on their hands all of a sudden. So we make that argument. The same has got to apply to players that are in the first team, not in the first. You played, so what was the difference? If you're not playing regularly.
I think over an extended period of time, we're talking now about a really extended period of time for people like Adam Maguire. So that does become an issue, because all the things are true. It's cliche, but, you know, a bit match sharpness and just the speed with which you kind of react to incidents in a game and things, that does, I think that does slightly diminish and weaken and dampen the longer you're out the team. But over a shorter period, it's no big issue. You can keep, you know, very sharp and fit in training. But for Maguire, it's been a full season. And there's no real prospect of it changing. You know, there are short-term injuries, but the one thing you have to say is, he, you know, we're saying all this, we're talking about Harry Maguire, I'm sure he will back himself now if he thinks, I'm going to get a chance now that there are injuries to get in the team. It's up to me to stay in it. And like that, you have to say that's his prerogative as well.
It is, and that's admirable mentality, and I think that's exactly how he will be thinking. But the reality is that Erik ten Hag is not a guy who changes his opinion easily and doesn't listen to external noise, as we've seen with Cristiano Ronaldo. And I just think a year down the line, I don't see it changing for Harry. And I understand he may feel that he's had a summer where he really hasn't been treated as he would have hoped to have been treated, as someone that's given the club good service, was the captain, had the captaincy taken off him, and then, you know, United were arranging a deal that he felt, may have felt he wasn't getting a say in. I can understand all of those from a kind of ego point of view, but I think it's just got to be real and say, I don't think Ten Hag's going to change his mind.
The only other thing would be with this squad is how much protection Southgate gives Henderson in terms of whether he gets put up for the media, whether he's given the opportunity to talk. Because Southgate went on TalkSport a few weeks ago around the time of Henderson's move and defended him and defended his right to move there. But I think, particularly because of the situation he's in Saudi, he hasn't been given an opportunity to talk at all without you know, a great deal of control around the media situation he's in. I would be fascinated to hear from him and to have difficult questions asked of him.
Do you think the FA will allow that?
I don't think they will. Being completely honest, I don't think they will. But I think that a lot of fans, particularly LGBT fans up and down the country, feel they've got a right to hear from him on it.
And 100%. I think the trouble for the FA, if they try to keep him away from the media, is I think Jordan, what's probably been 80 squads, and he's one of the most enthusiastic and best media performers he's probably been. He's probably done one of the press conferences in 80 of those squads. So it would actually be a story if they kept him away.
Yeah,
it would be. There's some people that noticeably always come in and do the media, and Jordan is one of those guys. Ashley Cole would never come in and do the media.
No, that would be a surprise.
And during Glenn Hoddle's time, Darren Anderson, because Darren Anderson had a positive experience with Eileen Drury, Darren Anderson was always put up every single media session or whatever, to the extent that we were all during the World Cup in 1998, we're all sitting around a table like this, and Darren Anderson comes in for, must be about his 10th consecutive press conference, 10th consecutive day that Down and we've been up before the media. And we're all sitting around there and it's just, you know, nothing to say. And John Dillon is sitting at the front of it, great lad, John. And he goes, there's this silence sort of opens up because there's nothing left. And he says, well, Down, he said, anything you want to know about us? Jordan is that he's not exactly that sort of guy, but
I don't think
Jordan
he'll be lacking a tone if he does speak.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be as loosey-goosey as that. Yeah, if Jordan comes in.
And also, and I think Gareth won't want the whole camp to be overshadowed by either, you know, a big story around why is Jordan Henderson being shielded, or whatever Jordan Henderson does say, you know, which will be a story.
Okay, still loads to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed and visit the website for the latest subscription offer.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So, Luis Rubiales, this guy's just not reading the room, is he? It's the story that just keeps on evolving. Since we last spoke on Monday, we spoke about this on Monday, but Ruby Alice's mother locked herself in a church and went on hunger strike. She's since been moved to hospital. And a video has emerged of Hermoso and her Spain teammates perhaps joking about the episode in the aftermath of the game. We should say there's another video of Hermoso saying how much she did not like the kiss, and she has made it very clear she didn't consent. But it's remarkably still in place. And it's really a pretty damning indictment on football that this man has overshadowed the achievements of the Spanish woman, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, there couldn't be in many ways a worse indictment that the team that wins the Women's World Cup immediately are overshadowed by their own president engaged in we've got to be careful what we say legally here, but certainly behaviour that one of their star players found distressing, found something, you know, that happened against their will, and that instead of there being universal condemnation, we've got a scenario where the women of Spain, women players, no longer want to play for the team, and the Spanish government are with them, and many male footballers are with them, but the federation's clinging on to its president, or he's clinging on to the power in the Federation. His own uncles come out and condemned him. His uncle, who was
incredible,
amazing,
astonishing, you know, evisceration of his
character and what he's like as a narcissist and as a sort of, you know, predatory and egotistical kind of guy. I just think, you know, the wider picture here is how football systemically deals with the treatment of women in this particular issue. And I, you know, I wrote about it at the weekend. I just think it's miles behind, if it's even anywhere at all on this issue. And you think how, in terms of other major societal issues, racism, maybe homophobia is not quite as far advanced as, or certainly isn't as far advanced, but it, as with racism, but it's better maybe. But with issues around misogyny and you know, gender-based abuse and all these kind of things, football hasn't even had the conversation and is nowhere and has given no thought to it, really, comparatively. And we've got to point out that Rubiales is a UEFA vice president. And UEFA have been extremely mealy-mouthed about this. They seem more bothered about stoppage time than they are about Luis Rubiales. You know, what does that say to women? What does it say to women players? What does it say to women supporters? What does it say to women generally? We can all think of other aspects, and I tried to cover some of them in the piece, where women may feel that football's just not a place for them, whether as fans, whether on online forums. You think of how some footballers treat women in social settings, some of the court cases we've seen in recent years, some of the players who are at the moment dealing with legal issues. I mean, there's a panoply of things here, but this is the next big thing I think football needs to move on. And Rubiales is one of it may be the most spectacular and grotesque of the stories, but there are so many other ones too, and other ways in which the game's got to change.
What have you made of the episode, Martin?
Well, a vote last week that I thought his position was untenable last week, and I'm frankly astonished that he's still in the job. He took to enter into colloquialism. He took a liberty, basically, an old-fashioned liberty taker, basically, you know. And I'm just amazed that he hasn't. Well, you talked about reading the room. I'm amazed that he hasn't accepted that. Even if he was to survive this, even if there was a sort of inquiry into it and he was to be exonerated, you can't run an association if nobody wants to play for you. So you've got to, you know, I think it was David Miller's statement that when he resigned from the government, that he felt he had become a point of weakness in the government and had no option but to resign. Well, that's what Rubiales is. He's a point of weakness in the Spanish Federation, and he really has no option but to resign.
But he hasn't. There are 80 players have said they want to play for Spain.
No.
Two-thirds of his federation have said they'd want to play.
Look, and you know, this video that has emerged and the coach and everything like that would, under normal circumstances, be quite compelling evidence in a court of law. That would definitely be seized on by any defence lawyer or whatever and put in, and that's what Rubiales is trying to do. However, the fact that people aren't giving it perhaps the run that he would have expected shows that people are just going, despite this, what you did was wrong and what you did should not have happened.
I'd just say on that video, Jenny Hermoso's got every right to, as she said, reflect and
and feel and let what happened to her kind of sink in and feel violated as a result, which is what's happened. And in the moment,
she just won the World Cup.
She's just won the World Cup. In the dressing room, she's
embarrassed
on film saying, I didn't like it. And yes, there's another video where they're joking about it on the team bus, but she's in an awful position as a woman, in a position of weakness, with somebody who's in a great position of power, her own federation chief, who's appointee as the women's manager. She's in a horrendous position there. And if in that moment she's joking about it, who knows what her real feelings are, but she's got every right to reflect and say, look, this was not what I wanted, and this is something that has traumatized me, and I've got every right to seek redress for it.
If you go back to Mark Palios, Furia Alam, and the Football Association, I don't know what to call it, sex scandal, I don't know what it was. It was a scandal, certainly it was a scandal. Part of that was to do with abuse of power. Everyone was single.
Yeah.
To be fair, everyone was single. Yeah. They could be at it like rabbits. See if we care, basically. But it was to do with the fact that the woman in that was a secretary at the Football Association, or personal assistant at the Football Association, and the man in that was the head of the association. And that imbalance in the workplace is what made it a scandal as such, and what in the end led to the resignation.
Not an easy question, but what if anything is going to make this guy resign?
Well, I was just thinking, do we know what the Spain men's team are doing about this?
I mean that's because their coach was seen applauding.
There's Borja Iglesias has said he won't play.
Yeah.
And he from my understanding, he's quite active politically. He's tweeted a lot about the election that happened recently in Spain. Yeah.
He has two caps, though, I think.
He has two caps. He's just broken into, and a very admirable thing to do for a guy that has only just broken into the Spain setup to effectively put his international career on the line.
Yeah.
But I mean, the obvious thing from my point of view would be for the men to make the exact same stand as 100%. The women, and that way that would send a great message. I find it the thing that I find so troubling about this is that it is the world champions who've had to make this stand. They've had to effectively forfeit their right to play football to try and get rid of somebody who they believe is just totally incompatible in that role now, and untenable in that role. Why don't the male players do the same?
They have to. They should do. But I think this is one of the fissures in this issue, which is that clearly men within the game, maybe men generally, don't feel as outraged about misogyny and the other spectrum of abuses of women, and they should. And I said this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Mason Greenwood, the idea that it should be the women's team that made the decision. Why? Is it only the women's team that should be outraged or have an opinion or whatever that opinion is? Mm. You know, men have got to get with this as well.
Yeah, the only Spanish players who've, other Spanish, I think David De Gea, Javi, they have. You know, they've less to lose, I'd imagine. I think that's...
Yeah. And retired players like Iniesta.
Yeah.
But the men's coach was applauding.
Yeah.
So he was sitting next to George Wilder, applauding Rubiales last week.
But they're under a lot of pressure, aren't they? They're put under a lot. Just as you were saying about Jennifer Moses, she would have felt quite pressured. If you're employed by the Spanish Federation and you've been sat in the front row, you're under a lot of pressure to applaud, basically, I wouldn't necessarily hold that against them because it's a extreme situation that they found themselves in there.
Maybe, although maybe I'm being idealistic, but I don't think Gareth Southgate would applaud in the same position.
No, I would hope not.
That's a good point. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this story continues to develop. Back to the football. There was lots of EFL Cup second round action this week. I was at Nottingham Forest against Burnley last night, and it's an hour and a half of my life I'll never get back. There were, I think, 10 changes for Burnley, I think, and 7 for Forest. and there wasn't a shot on target until the 90th minute winner from Burnley. So yeah, classic. And this has been the theme of the we have this conversation most at this time of year, most years. The teams who have otherwise had a positive start often make a raft of changes, lose all the momentum, lose that kind of air of positivity of the season. And I would say Spurs are probably the team that we could pick out that's happened to most in this midweek set of fixtures, who, you know, they lost on penalty kicks to Fulham.
It is because they've got that trophy pressure that hangs over them every year, and probably, you know, I guess the EFL Cup is the best chance they would have had of a trophy, but they could have done with winning that one, obviously. But then, I don't know, I watched Everton last night, and they might be, you know, enormously grateful to the EFL Cup, did I say trophy, by the end of the season, because they were staring down the barrel of utter Armageddon for their season against Doncaster. And they put Beto on from the bench, and suddenly they've got a player. They've got a number nine, who didn't only look like a good package of attributes for a number nine, you know, quick, powerful, great finish, knew exactly where the goal was. But crucially for me, he looked like a player who really wanted to make an impact and wanted to be a main man. I'm going to sort this out for the team. And that's what they've lacked. When you've seen them on the pitch, they've just lacked that figurehead. So that they could look back at that tie and think, thank goodness, you know, that's what started our season.
Is it, this is probably a very uncharitable thing to say. I was so delighted when Orient got knocked out in the first round.
Really?
Because your column you wrote recently about Kevin De Bruyne, Martin, where you were talking about your dad and how he used to want to watch the best players.
Yeah,
want to watch the best players.
Yeah.
When I was younger, I used to enjoy our team getting to the second round of the League Cup or whatever, because generally you'd see a Premier League team. You might get a Premier League team in the second round. Early in the season, you might see a new signing. You might see a couple of... But nowadays, it is so... The competition is so devalued to the point, in these early stages, to the point where, you know, even... I mean, the most damning thing, Orient made a raft of changes. We played Plymouth away in the first round, and we changed the entire team, pretty much. And gave loads of players who hadn't played in the first match a go, and some new signings and whatever. Mm. And it was seen as a kind of a freebie. And I think we'd have got Crystal Palace if we'd gone through, which would have been, you know, fine. Mm. And haven't played Crystal Palace for a number of years. But it's I'm looking at it as a lower league football fan now and thinking, well, there's one less game we've got to play, and there's another match where we won't get some injuries, and, you know, and I don't see it as a great loss.
I think you're crackers. I think you're crackers. You know, it's like an Orient, for God's sake. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, have a go. This is what I don't understand. Have a go. Let Crystal Palace put their reserves out. What I don't understand is why Orient are putting their reserves out. I can understand. You know, let Crystal Palace put their reserves out. I'll back Orient.
Yeah,
you know, because every time the Premier League team rests 11 players, they get beat. You know, if the other team wants to take it seriously, and I don't understand that as a fan. Try and win something. Try to become the first team outside the top two divisions since Swindon.
Well, Bradford got to the final, didn't
Bradford
they?
Bradford got to the final,
and obviously, that could happen. That would be an amazing thing. And you know, these and you know, I do. I mean, I do have a lot more enjoyment of the FA Cup. I believe that is a. I've long been a believer that we have too many cup competitions in this country, and it's just on purely on player welfare grounds.
Yeah.
You know. But it's, you know, I'm happy to be labelled as crackers because I'm glad we can focus on League One.
Do you know what I mean? I just don't get. I would look. You could come up from League One, and that would be great. So I'm not sure. But this is so early in the season. Yeah. You know, you winning League One is not dependent on whether or not you beat Plymouth, basically. And Plymouth are a better team than Leighton Orient, so you quite possibly would have lost anyway. So if you put the first team out, but I don't know, I'm a big believer in try and win stuff. I really am.
There were a couple of upsets. Lincoln Tom will be very happy about this.
We said we weren't going to mention Lincoln.
Yeah.
Edit that out, John. Okay.
Well, they got past Sheffield United on penalties. And Salford.
Salford, yeah.
Leeds. And Martin, we were speaking earlier about, you know, we're getting used to, you know, very partisan voices in studios, TV studios, but now there was probably to the biggest extreme we've ever seen.
I did a little piece in the Times, about it was about Jamie Carragher in the Newcastle game last Sunday, and it comes over to Jamie at half time, and they ask him what he thinks of the Trent Alexander-Arnold booking. And he says, well, you know, he says that if you throw the ball away, it's a booking, and, you know, but he says, but he was pushed. He was pushed first. It was a clear foul, which I thought it was. Yeah. So I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, I agree with you, mate. And then they say, what do you think of the Virgil van Dijk thing? And he says, well, I didn't think it was a sending off. And I'm sitting there thinking, no, I didn't think it was a sending off either. I actually thought it was the card that doesn't exist, the orange card. I thought it was a little bit more than a yellow and a little bit less than a red. But we can't give orange cards, so that doesn't really make any difference. But but both times I agreed with him. But the problem was, and this is the point I was making, is that all the broadcasters now, what they want is they want to create these Uber fans out of their pundits, out of their co-commentators and everything. Yeah. And so when Jamie says that, because they're desperate to show film of the man celebrating a Liverpool goal. Now, we all know Jamie Carragher wants Liverpool to win. We know that. But you don't have to keep pushing it in everyone's faces. Mm-hmm. You don't have to turn him into this guy where they depict him as if he might just be sitting in the middle of the cop. Mm-hmm. He's a really good analyst, Jamie. And I just think it was completely unfair. Because he's given his honest opinion. Yeah. It was an opinion I agree with, but everyone, you went on the social media, or you went, oh, this is ridiculous, and biased, and all of this sort of stuff. It's not fair. And then we get to Tuesday, and Salford in the EFL Cup, and CoComs is Gary Neville, who part owns the club. And you're like, really? No one at Sky looked at that and went, yeah, it's a bit on the nose, that one, isn't it? You might as well have the manager in there, you know. Well, Liverpool, Newcastle, we went to the studio, Jurgen Klopp, what are you reckon of that? And you just think, come on, give these guys a break. Yeah. Don't put them in these. I always thought it was unfair when Jamie Redknapp would end up having to give his opinion on Tottenham when his dad's the manager. Just say, look, Jamie, for obvious reasons, we'll keep you clear of Tottenham this season. You can do everything else, but we'll keep you clear of Tottenham, or a match in which everything affects Tottenham. So say it's the last game of the season and it's deciding whether Tottenham are in Europe or not, we wouldn't ask you to commentate on that. But they don't, they want to. And it's not just Sky, it's the BBC, with Alan Shearer and Ian Wright. And they want to create these guys as massive fans all the time.
The thing that annoys me the most about modern punditry is the insertion of the word "we" into. It always used to be the case that there was
a bit late in Orient.
Yeah, I know. but I'm not paid the mega bucks by Sky.
I know, you can get away with
that. But that said, this was. But I was going to say that it was watching Chelsea Luton on last Friday, and seeing Mick Hartford.
And it's always been, I
play this little game where I often look at who's in the playoff bracket for the Premier League in the Championship, and I go, okay, so if Cardiff go up, who's going to be the most obvious club legend that's going to appear in the Sky studio for the Premier League next season? Because it does, I don't know when this changed, but it does feel like there has to be a representative from each club in the studio.
It was a few years ago.
I find it a bit of a nonsense, really, because you need to have objective analysis.
But without lifting the veil on our industry too much.
But
that pleases the club. The clubs want it too. And I remember Benitez, when he was Liverpool manager, years ago, sort of complaining about... Now, that he had a weird, odd complaint, because his complaint was that there were too many Liverpool pundits on TV, because he felt that was putting him under pressure.
Because they all thought they should be top of the league.
It was Hooley, and Hooley felt there were too many Liverpool pundits who had an opinion about his job, and he actually sent Ian Cotton, the old press guy, out of the room, go and bring the sheet back, Ian, and Ian had to go and fetch the sheet that Gerard had composed of the 21 Liverpool pundits that were on TV. But in general, the clubs actually, Liverpool want Carragher. You know, Man United might not want Gary Neville at the moment because of his opinion about the ownership, but the clubs like to have somebody that they feel that can speak up for them, that they can maybe even back channel a bit of comms to.
Some do a dual role as a club ambassador as well.
City, I think Man City must have been absolutely gutted when Vincent Kompany went into management.
It was just
made for it. Now they've got Micah, so that's
different.
Before Micah Richards, it was Mike Summerby, and Mike went on there and described one of the greatest goals that anyone's ever seen as lucky, because it was scored by Wayne Rooney against Manchester City. If you remember, I think it was Mike Summerby was in the studio, and he said he's come off his shin. He said he's lucky, and everyone's looking at it. It was one of the greatest goals, and I don't think Mike got invited back.
But when did Brighton get big enough to have their own Uber fan?
They've got a Glenn Murray. Glenn Murray does a bit as the Brighton representative. But it is that sort of thing. You know, Joe Cole going there and really talk up West Ham and stuff, and every West Ham fan is sitting there going, you're trying to Chelsea.
But this is the thing as well. It's someone like Glenn Murray, for whom played for a number of different clubs, at all levels, and yet it's kind of, he's got to be the Brighton sort of tub thumper this week. It is
strange. I do think it's strange. But
having said all that, we love your work, guys.
My point is that they're really good analysts. Really good analysts. They're not. These super fans, they can be, but it's this thing of Simon Bilic was absolutely mortified that ITV showed him jumping under the table when Dimitri Payet scored that fabulous free kick, European Championships in France, I think it was, and he scored, and he was Slaven's player, and Slaven is a very emotional guy. Jumps onto the table, literally jumps from his seat onto the table and punches the air. And he was mortified that they put that out.
Do you remember in the French TV coverage of that game? I don't know if you caught it, but the French TV had this thing where they when they interviewed a player, they projected a hologram of that player into the studio. So I remember Dimitri Payet sort of like Obi-Wan Kenobi materializing in the studio. It was amazing, and I was like, this is the future, we're going to get this in our TV, you know, anytime, and we still haven't got it. I want a hologram.
It's like tomorrow as well. We never got flying cars, neither did we. Talked about them every single week. Are they here? No.
Jetpacks.
Nothing.
We're looking a little bit nearer to the future. We'll look at, I think, a couple of games this weekend. We mentioned Brighton there, and Brighton Newcastle is one of the standout games of this weekend, because two teams who are trying to kind of gate crash the top, whatever number you want to give it now, six, seven. Four.
I make it seven. But every time I write seven or whatever, you know, you just get a pile on
from the back end.
I've got the six that want to leave everyone behind, plus Newcastle because of the size of the back end.
That's
what I make it.
As we're saying, there's a possibility without a positive result this weekend that they go into the international break with 3 points from their opening four games, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we're not going to go overboard about this, but you know, it won't take long for pressure to fall upon Eddie Howe's shoulders.
No, pressure shouldn't be on Eddie Howe's shoulders at all, and I don't see pressure coming, let's say, from Dan Ashworth or anyone sort of football department level, but yeah, it's something I've been keeping an eye on, because the reality of any club in that position is when there's a lot of money going into a project and there's big expectations, is they do want it to be delivered. And Newcastle have played well this season, but they're stuck on 3 points, and then they go to Brighton, which is often is a really, really horrible place to go. And I'm just looking at that thinking, what does happen if they go in with 3 points? Do some of the questions from the ownership maybe start to get asked of Eddie Howe? Will there be noise in our business? Probably.
Will people be contacting phones to say he's taken the club as far as he can go? Yeah. You remember when Alan Kirby had taken Charlton as far as they could go? Yeah. Turns out that wasn't true, did it? Because they could go a lot further. Yeah. You know, they could go into League Two, for instance. You know, that's where they could go.
But the same sort of questions were, you know, came up after they failed to see out the win or even to get a draw against Liverpool. Mm-hmm. So there is this kind of expectation now that they break into the league.
Totally, and look at their subs bench. This sort of myth that they haven't spent money. They have spent money. Yeah. I mean, they haven't spent Chelsea money. They haven't spent, you know, Todd Bowley money. You know, let's sort of hang about outside Stamford Bridge with a butterfly net and, you know, whatever comes in. but they have. They have spent money because you look at that bench and Harvey Barnes and these players. You know, there's been investment in the team, and you know, if we're being going back to that bottom line thing, brutally realistic, Saudi Arabia did not buy into English football to finish mid-table, even if last season was regarded as we've exceeded expectations. We're so further forward than we expected to be, but then you don't expect to go back to where you were.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's how far back are they going to permit them to slide? Yeah. You know, because it's as much of a pressure finishing in the top four because it's now, we're a Champions League club now. Yeah. And that's where they want them to be, ultimately.
Absolutely. And those first three games, I know everyone always says, it's just three games, it's only three games. And it's true, it's only three games. But you talk to, say, a guy like Dave Bassett, who's managed, you know, Wimbledon and Sheffield United and Leicester. Was Leicester in the top division when he was there? I can't remember. But certainly Sheffield United and Wimbledon. Yeah. And he will tell you that the first three games of the season, the first three or four games of the season, absolutely set the pattern for the rest of the season. You know, certainly in a smaller, Newcastle have obviously got the players. They played Manchester City, they played Liverpool, they played Aston Villa, a good team, have put five past them, you know, and now they're going to play Brighton. That's a very hard opening. They've got a lot of inferior opponents to play, in which they will without doubt rise up the table. However, the first three games does sort of set the tone for it, because the next time they play at St James's Park against a team they should beat, if you've only got 3 points, you can't afford to get a really unlucky draw. You can't afford to hit the bar four times and hit the post three times and come away drawing 1-1 with Sheffield United or whoever it is, you know, even though you should have beaten by 8 or something like that, because it all adds to that pressure that begins to build on you. You know, the teams that have got 0 points at the moment, it's going to be hard.
Yeah, I've got the Champions League draw to look forward to, which is happening. We were recording before that takes place.
You're calling for everything, but
absolutely. Unfortunate timing this week. Yeah,
really.
Two more teams looking forward to that will be Arsenal and Manchester United. Yeah. So big one at the Emirates this weekend. Two teams as well who've had a bit of a sticky start to this season. And I think, you know, again, it's early, but either one comes off the end of a wrong result, and it's kind of pressure will begin to rise for them too.
That's true. I mean,
the nature of the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, there's questions swirling around Mikel Arteta already, having had the season that he had last year. But that is what happens when you raise expectations and spend money, and no one's giving it any time to bed in. It's we're all making judgments now. Oh, he hasn't made the team any better. He's made it worse. You know,
did he need to make the changes?
Yeah.
That's
the judgment comes very quickly, doesn't it, on that? Arteta would probably say, well, here's the underlying statistics and we are getting better and just the results will come. But they, from that point of view, could really do with a win against United. And just to, you know, Arsenal's ambition is to win the title this season.
Yeah.
And we've got Manchester City who are a juggernaut and even going behind by 6 points, even in an early point of the season, is a problem when you're trying to chase Man City. Mm-hmm. So there's all of that. It's going to be a really interesting game because United are, I've seen them against Forest at the weekend. There's a real weakness in that team when you just drive through the middle of them. Mm-hmm. But Arsenal have actually gone away from that style of the speed of football to a much more studied
kind of way of playing, much more possession heavy in the middle. I just wonder if it might be one for Arteta to go back to just going fast to Martinelli and Saka on the flanks. So we'll see.
Which is ironic what Arsenal have done, because if you look at what Pep is doing at Manchester City, it is all about how many players can we get one-on-one.
Yeah,
it's all about all the guys that he's buying most recently, or most of the guys that he's buying most recently are right one-on-one. Let's, you know, you look at West Ham against Brighton last week. It was all about how many players they had. How can they get Antonio away one on one? How can they get Bowen away one on one?
I think Nunez is, I think, the second highest number of dribbles.
Last season
as well. So.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So, you know, it's very interesting the way that Arsenal have mapped their team out, because if we are to say that Guardiola is Arteta's mentor, his mentor is going in completely the opposite direction. Yeah. You know, he's going into that thing of, right, let's see if we can get some flying machine to be running at them. Yeah. You know,
our team's already starting not pressing Edison now, because they know that what's coming with that ball. So people are adjusting to a new Man City.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah. Okay, we'll finish with this is power going to my head here, because we're doing Bill Edgar's quiz and I don't have to answer. Just one question, I think.
Everyone tune in for 2 minutes of silence. Who's top of the league? Yeah, we can get that.
So this is about Arsenal and Man United, okay?
Right, okay.
Only once in these clubs' past 36 meetings has one team scored more than 3 goals. United won that league match in 2012. What was the score?
It was the 8-2.
8-2.
I've got a harder one. I've got a harder one, but it's...
Okay, give us a harder one.
This, we're at risk of silence here.
Yeah, okay. Because
Brentford and Bournemouth are playing each other this weekend.
We'll all be across this one.
Bill is magnificent. Brentford, Bournemouth and their fellow Premier League club Brighton and Hove Albion have played in all four league tiers in the 21st century. Three other B clubs have also played in all four tiers in that period. Can you name them?
In that period.
Bradford?
One.
Is it, what's the time period, Gregor?
Burnley.
Bournemouth.
Would Burnley be one of them?
No.
Bournemouth, yeah.
Yeah, no. But Bournemouth are including the question.
Yeah.
We've got
three more. So you've got Bradford.
Blackpool. Barnsley.
All four tiers.
See, Gregor is presuming a much more detailed knowledge of the fourth tier.
You've done pretty well.
Anyone around this Bolton.
Gee whiz. Okay, not too much silence.
Filled it in with mindless banter.
Bill's quiz. You can get Bill's quiz on the website. I got 8 out of 10, which I'm actually quite pleased about. Okay, Mark Samuel, Jonathan Northcroft, James Restall, thank you very much. Enjoyed that. If you enjoyed this show, make sure you're subscribed, leave us a review, and we'll be back on Monday.